coming up on Golf Today, Rory gets a soulful and complete victory at one of the game's most hallowed venues, Pebble Beach. How did he do it? And what does it mean for the rest of his year? Charlie Hoffman has some ideas on creating a more compelling PGA Tour. He's the latest player to call upon his peers for action. Find out what he said. And it is party time in the Arizona desert at the Greenest Show on Grass. It is WM Phoenix Open Week, and we are on site in the belly of the beast at 16. Buckle up. It's Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Oh, the People's Open is back, and our drone is up and running once again at TPC Scottsdale. Large and loud galleries, fully enclosed 16th hole, turning up the volume on the PGA Tour as high-level golf gets a little crazy this week in the Valley. It's so great for Golf Today to be back at the WM Phoenix Open. Damon Hack, Eamon Lynch with you once again. And how about this two-week stretch on the PGA Tour? You go from Cathedral to the frat house, from Mother Teresa to John Belushi. This is what it's all about.
It really is kind of nobility versus novelty, right? I mean, the purists and the partiers. Last week is what golf and golf fans imagine it to be. It's, you know, one of these iconic venues, the all-star leaderboard. This might actually be what the reality of the PGA Tour becomes in the future. Certainly when you're in a for-profit model, you're going to find bean counters who think this is closer to what the PGA Tour product ought to be than certainly what a lot of the traditionalists loved and enjoyed about last week.
On Monday, I said last week I thought that it was the best week that professional golf had had. And that was before Rory McIlroy won or Nellie Korda finished runner-up. Scottie Scheffler back, the world number one, another top 10 finish. Just how about this kind of time in professional golf, needing some feel-good stories in what's been a very difficult couple of years?
It really has been a dispiriting couple of years, but this year is starting promising, leaving aside all of the uncertainty around the politics of the game or what's going on outside of the ropes. You have the number one on the women's tour getting some rivals closing in on her. We saw that over the weekend in Orlando. We saw Scottie Scheffler's rivals start to show a little bit of teeth over the last few days at Pebble Beach. In fact, Rory McIlroy talked openly about how he was inspired by Scottie Scheffler. He wants to play that kind of golf. That's the impact Scottie Scheffler is having on these guys. It's setting up just purely inside the ropes.
Yeah.
It's setting up to be a great year in this sport.
And Rory McIlroy was in full flight at the Monterey Peninsula. Time now for Sunday Best. In case you missed any of his handiwork, his 27th victory on the PGA Tour. This was Sunday. Rory tied for the lead at the par 3 7th after a wonderful tee shot.
Pulls that one in for birdie. That gets him the solo lead at 17 under par.
Gorgeous afternoon. Making the left to right putts and making them look easy here now at the par 4 10th.
Doing pretty good on those left to righters, Damon.
Back to the lead at minus 17. Now on the par 3, 12th, a couple holes later.
And the iron play was so good, sometimes you don't even really have to make much of a putt.
Oh,
knocks this one in right there. He made that birdie. Got to 18 under.
Iron play was spot on all week. His wedge play in particular. How about the 14th hole, though? This was just two mighty swats to set up this eagle putt.
Ripped the driver. 7 iron. Right here. Drains it for eagle. 20 under par, and the lead is 4.
Oh, to walk that back 9 with the lead growing and growing. Now, the par 4 15th, he owned this hole this past week.
And this is about as close as he hit it all week, apart from that ace in the first round. Cozies that one in, another birdie, 21 under.
Oh, enjoying that walk. One of his best friends in the game, and Shane Lowry, the 18th hole, this par putt. Elementary.
We could all make that one for the win, Damon.
Most of us could. How about that weekend? A 65-66, wins by a couple. Kind of shades of Canada and Congressional, Valhalla, Rory McIlroy in full flight.
And here is the list of guys with most wins on the PGA Tour since the 2017-18 season. McIlroy, top of that list. It's about the only list Scottie Scheffler's number two on. John Rahm, Justin Thomas, completing that foursome. And after his victory, Rory met with the media.
Yeah, look, there's some venues in our game that just mean a little bit more than others, and that's probably to do with the history and the people that have won on those courses and what those people have meant to the game of golf. I've had a few close calls at St. Andrews, which is, you know, another one of those important venues in our game. Augusta National being another one too. So to be able to get a win on, you know, one of those iconic venues is awesome. It's, you know, it's a very different test this week than what you would typically expect at a US Open. So, you know, got to take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But, I finally feel that my game can travel to any sort of golf course, in any conditions, in any setup, really. You know, I feel like I'm a very well-rounded golfer, and I can adapt to whatever I need to adapt to. And, I was able to show that this weekend, you know, especially yesterday with those conditions.
You talked a lot about the bogey-free rounds and the desire to shoot more of those. How do you actually go about it, whether changes to your swing, course management? How do you shoot more bogey-free rounds?
I think there's two parts to it. I think it's strategy. So it's hitting... sorry, I'm going to move this. This is... I hate when my trophies get in the way. It's strategy and picking more conservative targets at times, and maybe picking more conservative clubs off tees. But then I think the big thing is obviously short game as well. I've alluded to it this week a little bit. My short game last year was a little up and down. It was a little, I'd have a good week, then I'd have a bad week. There wasn't a ton of consistency in it. So, those are, the up and down on one, for example, today. It's a big up and down just to get things going. The up and down on four, same sort of thing. It's two parts. It's the strategy, and I think every time that I'm a big admirer of Scotty's for a lot of different reasons, but every time I play with him, and I watch how he plays and how disciplined he is, it's a really cool thing to watch. And, you know, I've alluded to it this week, but, you know, honestly, just trying to take a little bit of a leaf out of his book.
So how much have you reflected on Scotty, and how does that compare to how much you look at other players' game, and what impact has kind of that reflection on Scotty had on how you go about the game now?
Yeah, I think, you know, when someone, one of your peers has the year like he had last year, and honestly the year like he had in 23 as well, you start to take notice at, you know, what is he doing and what has made him or helped him separate himself from the rest of the field. And to me, those are the two big things that he does better than anyone else. And it takes a certain mindset to do that too. You know, he's not, you know, there's impulses that I have on the golf course that it looks like Scotty doesn't have. And I have to rein those in, and I have to try to be a little more disciplined about it. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Rory, you said a couple minutes ago that you're finally a complete golfer. I'm wondering, when did you arrive at that, and what were the missing pieces?
Maybe I should have rephrased that. Maybe not finally a complete. I don't know if any of us should describe ourselves as complete, because, you know, that means there's nowhere left to go. There's no improvement left, and that's certainly not the case. But I just think more that... My game can travel. I can win on different venues, different tests, you know, firm courses, soft courses, windy, calm, rain, long golf courses, short golf courses. You know, anything that I feel is thrown my way in the game, I feel like I'm prepared to handle it. That's what I meant.
But is that something that you've discovered in the last few years?
I think so. I think it is. I think it comes with age, it comes with experience, comes with a little bit of maturity. I feel like over the past few years I've been able to not get frustrated as easily at things that I can't control, whether it be the golf course or the conditions or things like that.
This is Rory McIlroy's third time winning his season debut on tour. The previous two came at the CJ Cup. One played in Vegas, the other at Congaree in South Carolina, and those were both part of the fall portion of the PGA Tour season. This is the first time he's won his debut in a calendar year season on tour. And Damon, I would always argue in events like this, where you win matters, how you win matters, and against whom you win matters. And we had the best field of the year in Pebble Beach. We had one of the most iconic courses, certainly the most iconic course we've seen this year on the PGA Tour. The how he won, though, to me is the fascinating part of this, because it was more decisive than it was dominant, but it was gritty and smart.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily always the golf we've seen Rory McIlroy play. There's always been an impetuousness and a gambling instinct to his game, the tendency to hit the wrong shot at the wrong time, just reach for a little bit too much. We didn't see any of that. He said earlier in the week he wanted to play Scottie Scheffler golf, and he made one bogey over the last 36 holes in pretty tough scoring conditions, I think.
Yeah, 65, 66 on the weekend, and also the acknowledgement that his resume maybe lacked the classic venue victories. He felt that. He was asked about it, and he agreed with that. The fact that at the age of 35, he feels that now he has the game that can travel and handle any condition on any golf course on any given day. The acknowledgement that he has to limit the soft bogey. And then we also saw the reminder that there are certain shots that only he on the property could hit. For example, the tee shot on the par 5, 14th.
That you don't have that in the bag?
I don't have that, and nobody else could take the line that Rory McIlroy took, setting up that eagle. It was vintage Rory McIlroy, reminding us that maybe he, and not DJ, and not Sergio, not Greg Norman, not Tiger, maybe not anybody has driven a golf ball better than Rory McIlroy, height of power. But we've always known that this was there. Eamon, to me, the biggest revelation was the improvement in the short irons, the wedges that so often seem to come up short or leave him 30, 35 feet above the hole and then having to hit a two-putt and bringing three-putt into play.
Yeah.
He was laser-sharp aiming with his irons. This was just so fun to watch. And if this part of his game is working, that's what makes him so dangerous, I believe, going into the rest of the season. Of course, the hole-in-one at Spyglass on Thursday.
Yeah, and that continued all the way around Pebble Beach. He ended up 17th in strokes gained approach for the week at Pebble. You know, last season he was 52nd, and why that 17th is even more impressive is you're talking about the smallest greens these guys are going to see all year long on the PGA Tour. He was sticking it in there close all the time. And to me, it went even beyond the execution. It went to the attitude as well. Here you see him on the iconic 7th, where at least Shane Lowry had the edge over him this week on this particular hole. But again, another flighted wedge that he knocks down right there. But to me, the attitude was as important as the execution, because there's always been this rap against Rory McIlroy that whenever the conditions are tough, he lets his head drop, that he didn't have grit. And it's never really been true. A lot of it's based on the fact that Rory McIlroy, with 40-something wins, 42 wins around the world now, has still never won a tournament that finished with a winning score in single digits under par.
Right.
But the conditions were terrible out there on Saturday. Rory McIlroy shoots 65. You go back 2 years to when he won the Scottish Open, when he was flighting irons into the 18th hole to beat Bob McIntyre at the Renaissance Club in Scotland in heavy wind. Rory McIlroy does have that creative gear. Sure, he's got the gear that's just beautiful to watch when everything's going well. But what we've started to see more out of McIlroy is the ability to adapt.
Yeah.
And to me, that was the most impressive thing. It was an extraordinarily disciplined performance, and it sets up a great question for the rest of 2025. Can he maintain the discipline? We know he's got all the shots. Can he maintain the discipline that we saw in the last 4 days?
It had to be one of his most heartfelt, soulful victories. When you think about the week on the Monterey Peninsula, playing Cypress Point for the first time, making a hole-in-one at 15 at Spyglass.
It's a pretty good week, right?
Winning at Pebble with one of your best friends in the game, finishing second in Shane Lowry. I mean, that just from a soulful standpoint and the meaning of Pebble Beach to this game, this is not just a win. I think it's a win and a half. I think it should count for extra.
And to me, the intriguing part of it is the way he went about it looks repeatable. It wasn't as though he went out there and shot 30 under par and produced a level of golf that you're just not going to see week to week. Rory McIlroy didn't do anything this week that you wouldn't expect him to do next week when he shows up at Torrey Pines as well. It looked repeatable, and to me, that's the intriguing part of this.
Command performance for the four-time major champ. Let's take a look at the leaderboard one more time. 65-66 on the weekend for the 35-year-old Rory McIlroy. Some would say his best days are behind him. Tell you what, back in the day, 35 was the prime, was the high point for golfers, and maybe it will be again for the man from Hollywood, Northern Ireland. A lot to discuss on this Monday. Time for a Golf Today roundtable. We welcome in Golf Channel senior writer Rex Hoggard and Golf Digest senior writer Joel Beal. Joel, I want to start with you. The significance of this week for Rory McIlroy was what?
Honestly, I love one of the things I really enjoy about Rory is this idea of self-improvement. Despite being kind of at the top of his game for, or top of our game for what, 15 years now, he's always looking to improve. He's also very impressionable. I get what he's saying about trying to emulate Scheffler a little bit, but he said similar things about Dustin Johnson, about Brooks Koepka. Sometimes I just want to be like, man, just be yourself. He needs to have a little more conviction in who he is. And while I agree with you, cutting down the mistakes was big, especially Saturday, you know, telling Harry, hey, I'm just going to chip it around. I'm taking the big number, keeping that out of play. That means a lot. We also, as you just showed, the drive on 14, he was up two. There was no reason to take that line. He needs some of that drunken cowboy occasionally. And if he can just kind of fuse those two together, I think you'll really see maybe a Rory McIlroy that's fully actualized. But what does it mean? I don't want to get too far ahead because kind of Rory's blessing is also his curse, right? When it looks good like it does over the weekend, you kind of wonder why it doesn't always look that good. The problem is that's an unfair expectation and not realistic. So, he seems comfortable with this game. He seems extremely confident where he's at, his mindset. He just needs to keep that up and not kind of question himself as he goes on. Because let's be honest, you know, as good as it looked, Rory's at that point now where we really only judge him on 4 weeks, and those 4 weeks matter more than weeks like last week.
That's certainly fair, Rex. What did you see out of Rory this weekend? And did he seem more disciplined to you? And does that seem something that's portable for Rory McIlroy through the season?
It's certainly impressive that he would look at what Scottie Scheffler is doing and try to take some of that and implement it in your game. And you could see parts of that certainly on Saturday, as you guys pointed out. It was awful conditions at Pebble Beach. It was quintessential Pebble Beach conditions. And he shoots 65, which I always kind of look at. How does that rank to the rest of the field? That was 6.5 shots better than the scoring average that day. He got up and down 8 out of 8 times. That's very Scottie Scheffler-esque. However, on the other side of this, I kind of agree with what Joel said. It's the DNA that makes Rory so compelling to watch. And I think we saw that on Sunday, the 14th hole being the perfect example. It reminded me of 2012 when Rory was at maximum Rory winning at the PGA Championship. And he kept hitting driver at Kiawah, not because he had to, because he wanted to, because he could. He knew he could get away with it. And I think that's what we saw on Sunday at Pebble. Some sort of combination of those two things, I think, is very sustainable.
Well, Rex, we both have boys. My boys are all about power rankings when they watch the NFL. Are you team Lamar Jackson? Are you team Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen? Where are you in the power rankings on the PGA Tour? I know what the official golf ranking says, but the world number one's coming off injury. Xander's hurt. Did anything you saw at Pebble Beach say, you know what, I think Rory McIlroy should be number one in the power rankings? Your answer is what?
I don't think he should be number one because I don't think you can kick Scotty out of that just because of some sort of cooking experiment that went wrong over the holidays. They got him injured and had him start the season late. But I think he's squarely number two for the reasons you just pointed out, that we're waiting for Xander to come back from the injury that he talked about. Colin Morikawa had to withdraw. It seems like everybody in that universe right now is dealing with something or another until they get to full stride. And whatever it is that Rory found in that dark closet when he decided to lock himself away at the end of last season and find something different about his swing, find something in the motion instead of the actual flight of the ball, it seems to resonate. Look at the way he finished up last year and certainly the way he has started this way. I'm with Joel. I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment here, but you can't look at what Rory did last week at Pebble Beach. Everything well. First, and strokes gained off the tee, third and strokes gained tee to green, seventh and putting, If you look at, if he does that, then that is the 2012 version of Rory McIlroy that would win majors by multiple strokes. And I think he's squarely number two.
Joel, golf fans and certainly golf writers have seemed to have a lot more to commiserate than to celebrate over the last couple of years. How important was it, from just from a philosophical standpoint, to have this golf course, this leaderboard, and this winner early in the 2025 season?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was imperative, especially, I mean, gosh, the first month has been nothing about how bad the ratings have been. We've had slow play really dominate what's going on. Just the malaise that's continued to be in the background about, is this deal happening with PIF or not? And just the uncertainty that brings. They really need the bid week. And Damon, you touched on it earlier that even before the weekend, it was already kind of changing the narrative a little bit. It's actually a very simple formula for all the concerns we have and warranted concerns about what the professional game looks like and where it's going. This weekend just showed it's all these things we argue about. It's really simple. Just have good fields at good venues and the golf kind of takes care of itself.
Well, Joel, you know, I'm wondering if we're seeing a turning point in terms of slow play when Dottie Pepper on the broadcast is talking about it, when Frank Nabilo and sweet Jim Gallagher Jr. are having a go at Tom Kim. Are we seeing something that's going to go from just talk to maybe action? Charlie Hoffman, we're going to talk about him coming up. Talking about this is up to the players. Do you think something is going to change with even broadcast partners talking about it on the air?
It's certainly a start, and it's refreshing because the conversation is the starting point, but that alone is not going to do it. You know, we're not going to get absolute and uniform change until policing comes from the PGA Tour side. These guys can talk all they want. The problem is no one thinks they're a slow player, right? Until these guys are docked, until they're called out publicly for it, it's all just noise. So the Charlie Hoffman letter, I think Dottie Pepper's comments, you know, this is someone who doesn't suffer fools, but she also doesn't just shoot from the hip either. I think having a respected voice like that means a lot, but it's just the starting point of real change. We really need the PGA Tour to enforce any of these policies to make any of this talk mean anything.
Well, a lot of people are talking about the issue, and when we come back, our roundtable continues with a look at Charlie Hoffman's plea to his peers about slow play and more. Is there a fix? That's next on Golf Today. Another look here at the 16th, TPC Scottsdale, coming to you live from site this week. Charlie Hoffman in the field this week, runner-up last year to Nick Taylor, sent a note to tour membership Sunday night addressing several topics, one of which was the pace of play. He said the following: "We've taken a lot of heat over the past few weeks about slow play, and yeah, it's an issue for our fans, for us as players. Cutting down field sizes will help, but only by a few minutes a day. As players, we still need to make a concerted effort to speed up. We all need to take responsibility to be ready when it's our turn to play, and having the awareness to realize that we are out of position and speed up even before the rules official shows up. We do it all the time. We just need to be more aware of it!" Exclamation point. Went on to talk about many topics, saying many of you keep saying you want to play fewer events, yet you still find time for TGL, Race to Dubai, and other non-PGA Tour events, and that's going to continue regardless of field size. The best competition happens when the best players go head-to-head in a deep competitive field, not in small, limited entry events that leave deserving players on the outside looking in. This tour was built on open competition, where anyone with the game to compete has a chance to prove it against the best. That's what has made our tour special for generations, and we need to keep pushing for that. As our roundtable continues, Rex Hoggard and Joel Beal, senior writer of Golf Digest. Rex, I want to come to you. All of a sudden, the players have turned into Jerry Maguire without Renee Zellweger in the Goldfish. We got Justin Thomas with his note, and now Charlie Hoffman with his note. Just your thought, big picture, on what the players are going through in 2025. What are they trying to say?
Damon, I think all four of us on this roundtable can agree at least on one thing when it comes to this memo from Charlie Hoffman, is that he desperately needs an editor because he's all over the board with some of the thoughts that he has here. I get why he felt like he had to address slow play. The tour has come under quote-unquote heat, as he said, and that memo. However, it seems like he almost undercuts the idea by saying that it's something that he's talked about for 20 plus years since he's been on tour, and it was talked about for 20 plus years before he showed up. So I'm not quite sure what the message he's trying to send. It's also important to point out that not once but twice he served as a player director on the policy board, so he had the opportunity to make a difference, and he wasn't able to do that. So that one, to me, leaves a bit of a bitter taste in my mouth as it applies to the actual product, which is what Justin Thomas was trying to get to with his memo last month. I agree with it entirely. I think what we saw from Justin firsthand at the American Express, sending a long text message to our colleague Johnson Wagner Sunday morning, pointing out some of the things that he wanted to do in that final round, it made the broadcast better. It made Johnson better at his job. And I think it brought the fans in and gave them a perspective that they wouldn't have had otherwise. I think it's only going to help the product if you have more players following that lead from JT and now Charlie Hoffman.
Joel, are we seeing a shift in the conversation here when you take Charlie Hoffman's letter with JT's memo, that finally the players have shifted from talking about what they're entitled to versus what their actual obligations are to the product and to the fans?
Maybe, although I stumble when you say entitled, because that was, you know, that letter, it sort of reminded me of a football player, you know, going all the way down the field and you think he's going to score, and then 2 yards away he drops the ball before going in the end zone because Charlie was making a lot of good points, and then all of a sudden he has this rant at the end about the TGL, about Race to Dubai. He kind of left out that he was one of the guys left out of the Aeon 5 swing. I'm sure that had nothing to do with that rant. I mean, this is a guy who I like Charlie. He's had a very good career, but he's been there for 20 years. Tell me another sport where a guy who's kind of a rank and file player can exist for 20 years. And to think that he deserves a spot in Pebble just because he was outside the top, that just rubbed me the wrong way. You know, I do think there is a change in conversation, because there was kind of a pushback I heard from other players about Justin Thomas's letter. It was that, was the letter really from Justin, or was it one vetted by the tour and networks? Pretty clear that this letter came strictly from Charlie Hoffman. So it's great that he felt compelled to try to add to the conversation, to try to move the discussion along in the right way. I do worry, though, that we're maybe losing a sign of the plot with how scattered Charlie's thoughts were on the matter.
Well, Joel, let's not get too crazy, but he did mention TGL and Race to Dubai specifically. The only thing he didn't mention was Rory McIlroy by name, but was that in some way a shot at Rory, and kind of a maybe really how we're dealing with two tours right now? You've got the Rorys and the Scotties. You've got the guys who are in the speakeasy, and they're going to be there for a while in the signature events. And then you do have the rank and file. Just feels like an old school conversation between the haves on the PGA Tour and the have-nots.
A little, although I would argue Charlie is in that group. You know, he's on these boards. He's been out there for 20 years. I've heard this a lot the past couple of years, the haves and have not. That just doesn't exist on the PGA Tour. You know, it's haves and haves more. I'm with you that I think it was a little shot at Rory. I think it's, but he also gets the same amount of pushback from his, you know, European counterparts that he's not playing over there more enough. If anything, I think it's commendable that he's trying to serve both Masters, that he does see this as a global game, that he's trying to spread himself. I mean, that travel schedule for those guys that are playing in the Middle East and then flying to the West Coast, it's not easy. If anything, I think it's something that we should maybe commend these guys for doing more, even with the trip. You know, obviously, travel is a little easier being in first class and being a coach. But yeah, that part, I'm not sure what Charlie's issue is. And yeah, he also mentions these events should be open. I think one of our concerns when the tour moved to the signature model was that it'd be a closed shop. You know, enough turnover happened last year that showed, yeah, you can play your way into these events, and you can also play your way out. So it just seemed, I'm not sure what he was trying to get at, but the first part of the letter I agree with. Just at the end, he really lost me.
Rex, I want to kick it forward to this week here in Phoenix. After the debacle last year, the organizers say they have a new traffic flow problem or new traffic flow solution this year, but that wasn't really the problem last year. It's been decades of a behavioral issue at this golf course. Do you think what has been celebrated here over the years is finally going to be reined in, or how big a test is this year for the WM Phoenix Open?
Well, I think after last year, there was the fear that maybe they would overreact, the Thunderbirds, who run that particular tournament, where they would take away what kind of makes that tournament not special, but different on the PGA Tour. You're not going to get that situation. I think you can look back to last year and also point out those were extreme circumstances because of the weather, and there was a lot of people who were overserved and they didn't have anywhere to go, so that turned into a debacle. Who could have seen that coming? Now, on the other side of this, I think what they implemented this year, and I think the tagline that they've been working on is not bigger, but better. And I think that's probably a step in the right direction. You're still going to have unruly fans. You're still going to have things said to players on the 16th hole that aren't said anywhere else on the PGA Tour, maybe outside of the Ryder Cup. And there's still going to be thousands and thousands of fans who are overserved. The players who decide to play in this event, they've decided that, okay, this is for them. And I think players made up their mind on this one a long time ago. And for some players, not their brand of vodka, but the ones who like it, and I'll immediately point to Billy Horschel, because I think he was probably one of the most outspoken players last year about criticizing what happened. He's back this year. I think that in itself is a vote of confidence.
Not their brand of vodka. How appropriate this week, Rex. Thanks so much, Joel. Thank you as well. There's no event like it in golf. We're just getting started on this Monday. Golf Today is here. Golf Central is here. The world number one Scottie Scheffler in the field. Y'all stick around now. You hear?
We're back in golf today. Pinar Golf Club in Argentina was the host site for this year's Latin American Amateur Championship. The winner destined to receive a barrel of riches, an invitation to the Masters, as well as a spot in the US Open at Oakmont and at the Open Championship at Royal Portrush, and of course exemptions into the 2025 US Amateur and the Amateur Championship in Britain. Now, Justin Hastings of the Cayman Islands built a four-shot lead with an 8-under par 64, and then held on to win a 36-hole marathon on Saturday. Hastings is a senior at San Diego State and becomes the second player from the Cayman Islands in the last 4 years to win the Latin American Amateur Championship, joining Aaron Jarvis.
Also a two-time All-Mountain West selection. You mentioned it's his final year at SDSU. 71.43. Currently has the lowest career scoring average in program history, just ahead of a two-time major champ in Xander Schauffele. And Justin Hastings joins us now. Congratulations on the victory in Argentina. You know, darkness was falling, weather interrupted. What are you most proud of and how you handled your nerve coming down the stretch?
Yeah, just, I would say just being able to adapt on the fly. You know, we weren't sure how many holes we were going to get in on that Saturday. We were kind of told we were going to play as many as we could. We didn't figure out until the 16th hole, that final round, that we were going to get it done that day. And it was getting pretty dark on, you know, 15, 16. So just to be able to kind of adapt on the fly and get it done when it mattered most was something I'm pretty proud of.
Justin, I played golf in the Cayman Islands, and it's an understatement to say there aren't a lot of options down there if you're really into the sport. How did you find your way into golf down there?
Yeah, my dad's an avid golfer. You know, he took me out at 6 or 7 years old, and to be honest with you, I flew with it from there. I just, you know, in the span of a couple months later, I was getting dropped off every day after school, and in about a year, I was playing competitively. I don't know what it is about it. I just took to it really fast, and, you know, I've loved it ever since, obviously.
Well, your buddy Dennis Pashier sent me some photos of you as a roller hockey player back in the day. You tell us about your roller hockey career, because that's a tough sport, a little bit different, though, than holding 14 clubs.
Yeah, sure. Another kind of small sport on island, but no, parents are originally Canadian, so grew up a hockey household. That actually came before golf, and then, you know, as you can see there, played pretty competitive roller hockey until about 16 years old. It's a little bit of a dead end sport on island, so unfortunately I had to kind of give it up and stick to golf. But you know, I'd say it paid off. I'm pretty glad I did.
I know you're playing high-level college golf right now, Justin, but how important is the Latin American Amateur Championship in general to golfers of that region, just to have that opportunity to take advantage of that kind of stepping stone?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It does so much for golf in that region. You know, I feel like a few years ago it was very underrepresented, and I was lucky enough to play in, I think, the fourth edition as a young kid. I was 14 years old, and just to see that tournament grow into what it has now and produce the players and champions that it has in the last few years, guys like Joaquin Neiman, you know, and another an unbelievable list of other guys that have played in that event and are now, you know, successful on tour. I think it just shows the golf that we have down there, and I think this tournament's done a great job of bringing it out and, you know, showing it to the world.
Xander Schauffele, one of the most famous alums from the golf team at San Diego State, won two majors last year. What kind of pep does that give the golf team when you guys are walking around on campus? Are you following the X-Man? You know, what's it been like for you guys watching what he's been doing on the PGA Tour?
Yeah, of course. We're his biggest fans, especially with, you know, the last couple of years, the kind of breakthrough that he's experienced. And we've gained a little bit of relationship with him as well in these last couple of years. So to see the success that he's had his whole career, but especially the last couple of years, and to, you know, wear the same logo as him at some point, it's just something we're all super, super proud to be able to say that we do.
So, Justin, now you have a date the second week of April in Augusta, Georgia. Is Xander Schauffele the dream practice round, or is there someone else there that you just have this absolute fantasy that these are the guys you'd want to play 18 holes practice round with?
Yeah, I mean, Xander's the easy answer, right? That's just, obviously, that'd be a total dream come true. He plays that place amazing, and with the similarities with school, that would be great to see him out there. But no, I think it would be amazing to see how some of the more experienced guys that have played, you know, 20 Masters Championships, how they go play that place. So I'll definitely be keeping a keen eye out for the more experienced guys and see what I can learn before Thursday.
Well, we can't wait to see how the week goes for you. Justin, thanks for spending some time with us. Congratulations again on the success.
Thanks, guys.
There he is, Justin Hastings. And it is one of the most memorable weeks of the year. The Masters returns Thursday, April the 10th. Golf Channel has you covered all week with Live from the Masters, which begins Monday evening, April the 7th. And registration for the Drive, Chip, and Putt local qualifying is now open. Register your child today to begin their lifetime journey with the game of golf. Join in all the fun. Go to drivechipandputt.com to get started. What are the range for someone who's competed in the Masters, has two top tens in his career at the WM Phoenix Open? I'm speaking of Billy Horschel, finished tied for sixth here. Aiming in 2022. He's a big-time sports fan, Florida Gator football fan. Might need a helmet this week inside the ropes.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing you'd expect Billy to embrace to a point. You know, he does, like, you know, behavior, but he doesn't mind a little bit of a party atmosphere, and he has embraced it in the past, but he's also spoken out, particularly last year, against elements that he didn't see. But he's in good form right now. He's coming off a tie for ninth at Pebble yesterday, and it's only a few months ago that he won the 10th pole event on the DP World Tour, the BMW PGA Championship, when he took down Rory McIlroy when it mattered. Sort of a rematch of that old Walker Cup battle of theirs 20 years ago.
And no surprise to see Billy Ho grinding on a Monday. He'll acknowledge that sometimes he might overpractice. You know, loves the technical aspect of the game, wants his swing feeling, you know, if not perfect, nearly perfect, and sometimes that can work against him.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago when we saw Billy Horschel close to tears after shooting around in the mid-80s at the Memorial. Kept grinding at it, though, and he has been a winner since. And, you know, that is, to me, the Billy Horschel tenacity is what you'd like to see in almost any golfer. Yeah. At this stage, he's forged a pretty great career for himself, while by his own admission, not being exceptional in the sense of having weapons like a Rory McIlroy's driver or Xander Schauffele's putter or something like that. He's an extraordinarily solid player, but he's an absolutely impeccable competitor.
Golf Today, brought to you by Bushnell Golf, the number one rangefinder in golf. And by WM. WM is driving sustainability. Learn how at WM.com.
Back on Golf Today, have an early candidate for shot of the year in case you missed this. Final round at Pebble, par 5, 18th, Cam Davis dealing with some tree roots, risking a sculled shot or even worse, maybe injury. Stuffs it for a closing birdie, maybe the best we've seen in 2025, Eamon Lynch.
Can you imagine how Jordan Spieth feels watching this shot coming off a fresh wrist surgery?
Wow.
That's the danger zone.
Oh, to be young.
And fearless.
Absolutely. But it got us thinking, you know, we've seen so many wonderful shots, iconic moments throughout the history of the AT&T Pebble Beach Prom and also the U.S. Open as well. I thought it'd be kind of fun to look back through the years. Don't you think this is one of the most iconic venues in our sport?
And it's got some of the most memorable shots we've ever seen. And we're not talking about Jack Lemmon dangling over the edge of the cliff trying to hit one. Let's go back to 1972 U.S. Open, 71st hole. It's often forgotten, Lee Trevino hit driver on this hole playing right before Jack Nicklaus came up short. Jack didn't. The one iron kisses the hole and finishes right there for a birdie.
219 yards away, white shirt, yellow sweater. How about 10 years later, Tom Watson, same hole, told his caddy Bruce Edwards, get it close, I'm gonna make it. Birdied 18 also and beat Jack by two.
That was the shot that put him ahead of Jack. Move on another 10 years. Seventh hole, Tom Kite. Blustery conditions. Shadow of a bird flies by. Tom holds it. What looked like it was going to be a bogey becomes a birdie. He went on to win his first major championship.
Also looked like Colin Montgomerie was going to win a major. In fact, Jack congratulated him. Monty finished third. The year 2000, Tiger Woods' height of power. Par 5-6.
What was it Roger Maltby said?
It's just not a fair fight. And it wasn't. A 15-shot victory for the now 15-time major champ.
And of course, Tiger doesn't get just one memorable shot on Pebble. This was the 2010 U.S. Open. The only highlight we're showing here where the guy didn't go on to win. Graham McDowell, of course, the winner that year, but another stunning shot by Tiger Woods, just curving it around the trees.
Two-putt birdie, back 9-31, third round, 66, and yeah, the cream-colored outfit. What a time it was, and what a golf course. And one of the question marks is about the game. Yeah, how important are these golf courses, these classic courses? And to hear Scottie Scheffler talking about his mindset playing on a golf course like Pebble, seeing the history when you have the likes of Jack and Tiger, Tom Watson, Tom Kite, you can't make up that kind of history. That history is part of the DNA of Pebble Beach.
Yeah, I think context has a tremendous amount of value in this game. There's a familiarity. That's why the Masters is consistently the fan favorite among the majors. They understand where dreams have come undone and where dreams have been realized on that golf course because there's an intimate familiarity for the fans to the golf course, even if they've never been there. The same is true of Pebble. And when you have major championship history on top of the year-to-year PGA Tour history, I think that does offer a frame of familiarity that's really important to golf fans. But I also think, you know, we heard Rory talk yesterday how it mattered to win at a cathedral of golf rather than what he referred to as kind of the run-of-the-mill TPCs. And that's all great in theory, but great venues are a limited currency, really, because frankly, the majority of them are private. A lot of memberships are not willing to give up their club because that starts weeks in advance of the tournament, and then the tearing down of all of this infrastructure you see here and the damage to the course by the spectators takes it out for weeks after that as well. There are finances involved as well. So while everyone wants to talk about the need to have these iconic world-class golf courses that everyone recognizes as the pinnacle, as the week-to-week venues, it's simply not a feasible idea.
Yeah, it may be getting harder and harder to go to those venues, but when you see one of the best players in the modern era go 65, 66
on the weekend, appreciate them all the more.
It's a reminder how beautiful and soulful and magical it can be. Of course, we're very happy to be here at TPC Scottsdale. This, a wonderful venue, especially with our drone flying high on a gorgeous Monday. Golf Today is with you. Golf Central is here. We're here all week long at the WM Phoenix Open. Let's bring in Beth Ann Nichols, Golf Week magazine. You were at the season opener. Your biggest takeaway from Nelly, even though she didn't go away with the trophy, how formidable does she look in 2025?
I think the word that comes to mind is comfortable. She looks really comfortable in the position that she's in, which is saying a lot, considering the expectations that we all have for a player coming off of a 6-win season. It really felt like this was a continuation of 2024, especially the end when she won at the Annika. you know, she only took a week off before she got right back to work. And, you know, you see this putt here on 18. She knew she had to make that putt to have a chance, and she drained it. So she goes into this week on home soil at Bradenton Country Club feeling really good, knowing that after this she gets a really long break. So I think it really helps her mentally to be able to stay in the moment, really pour everything she has into it, knowing that even though it's been a really long run, you know, for her, that she's going to have a sizable break coming up really soon.
Bethan, A-Lim Kim was very much an unknown when she won that U.S. Women's Open almost 5 years ago, but she did win last year on the LPGA Tour. She's won this week. She's won in tremendous style against a hard-charging world number one. She's looking awfully comfortable out there.
She absolutely is. And when I think back to the A-Lim that we all met in 2020, you know, playing with that mask at that December U.S. Women's Open, we really didn't know her at all. You know, she birdied the last three holes. She kind of came out of nowhere. And you know, she's learning about us at the same time we're really learning about her. Didn't speak English. And then now, you know, fast forward to this week, she's making jokes. We're having a really good time in the press room, you know, communicating with her in English. From time to time, she would ask for a little help understanding a question, but we really got to see her personality and see how much fun she's having out here on tour. You know, she had so much to learn. The learning curve was massive from food to English to grass. And she's made a home here in Orlando, you know, with Amy Yang. She says, you see Amy right there is her hero. You know, they live close to each other in Orlando. Amy practices out of Bay Hill and A-Lim out of Isleworth. They share the same swing instructor. A-Lim's working on learning how to fade the ball, which is a new thing for her. And, you know, even though she felt uncomfortable out there at times, she stuck with it and really had a lot of success. And so, you know, I really feel like, you know, we're really going to see what she's made of here coming soon, because I mean, she's really seemingly hitting her stride, winning two of the last four starts.
You know, Bethann, someone else who seems to be having a lot of fun is a former world number one in Jin Young Ko. Like Morgan Preswell, I think she had her dog out there in the LPGA season opener. Where is Jin Young Ko at this point in her career?
Never underestimate the power of a dog, David. And that this dog's name translates to awesome, by the way. I think that the interesting thing about their awesome is with the sunglasses on and everything else, the dog was cracking me up all week. Walked every hole with sometimes in a backpack with Jin Young. But, you know, I think it's interesting that typically she would spend the off season, you know, going to a warmer climate in Asia with her swing instructor, with a bunch of other younger golfers who she said would, you know, look to her, you know, throughout that time. And she felt like she couldn't take a break. She didn't want to let them down, you know, so she was grinding hard and she thought, you know, I need to do something a little bit different. And so instead of going, you know, on a retreat, so to speak, with training camp with her coach, she instead came down to Florida for the first time with her parents in the off season, and awesome made his the first flight overseas and suffered a little bit of jet lag, but, you know, had the comforts of home here with her in Florida for several weeks. And she really looked refreshed, seemed hungry for the 2025 season. She plans to play, she said, she has 23 more events to go in the season, which we haven't seen her play, you know, 20 plus events since 2019. So this could be a big year for Jin Young. And you mentioned earlier the PGA Tour looking for rivals. You know, we've been waiting for Nelly and Jin Young to have this big rivalry. So maybe this is going to be the year.
I love those doggy sunglasses. I might need to get some sunglasses for my dog Skittles, Boxer Lab, a little bit bigger than awesome. Bethann, you're awesome as always. Thank you so much for your time on this Monday.
Thanks, guys.
There she is, Golf Week senior writer Bethann Nichols. Stick around for more Golf Today. Coming up, we're taking a closer look at TPC Scottsdale, the host site for this week's WM Phoenix Open. We'll be joined by a guy who knows his way around these parts. Won't be on the drone. We'll be with us at the desk. Back on Golf Today on this date in history, 2016, Eldrick the robot, not Eldrick Tiger Woods. This is a mechanized golf ball testing device, makes a great pass at it and makes a hole in one on the famed 16th here at TPC Scottsdale during the Pro-Am, and the folks went nuts.
We are live from TPC Scottsdale, and a reminder that you can catch first round coverage of the WM Phoenix Open live Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Golf Channel. Now, Joe Patsoff has played more golf courses and certainly more great golf courses than just about anyone we know. His current tally is 1,369 in all 50 states and most corners of the world. But the longtime architecture and travel writer calls Scottsdale home, so who better to talk some TPC Scottsdale with than Joe Patsoff. Joe, great of you to join us. Thanks again. I know you were here with us last year as well. This golf course is pretty central to this town. It's become very fashionable in this game of late, and we heard Rory kind of imply the same thing yesterday, that TPCs aren't all that. How does this one compare to, say, like TPC Sawgrass, TPC PGA West?
Damon, Eamon, thanks for having me. I mean, yes, the way the old course fits the town in St. Andrews, you could say the same thing about Lahinch. TPC Scottsdale is so centrally important to this town's identity, its economy, and everything else. Okay, so if Rory called Pebble Beach a cathedral, I kind of look at TPC Scottsdale as more of a bounce house. I mean, you kind of flop around from one fun hole to the next, especially on the back nine, but it was built to host tournaments. And that was the goal that, well, Dean Beaman, Pete Dye, had with TPCs. So how does TPC Scottsdale compare with the other TPCs? Shoot, Sawgrass is the pinnacle, okay? I mean, there's hazard value and awesome stuff going on virtually every hole. Absolutely dynamic finish. But don't shortchange the back nine at TPC Scottsdale. The front nine isn't terribly memorable, but as Weisskopf stated at the beginning, it was designed and has played more difficult. The back nine, a little easier, but a lot more drama because so much can happen on so many different holes.
Let's take a look at the back nine in particular. Let's look at 11 and 12. I love how you call this a bounce house. I call it a frat house. There's a party on every hole.
This is number 11 we're looking at, Joe.
Well, number 11 is, to me, one of the most underrated par fours on the tour.
Wow.
And it's because instead of bomb and gouge, it's restraint and precision. See where the water's coming out on the left? That means you can't overcook a drive, especially with your driver, because you're gonna find the water. But yet you don't wanna stray to the right, you know, and wind up in the desert. Now look what's going on as you approach the green. The hardest hole location, and it makes it the hardest hole on the golf course, is far back left, behind the bunker and closest to the water. Okay, we remember in 2019, the year Ricky Fowler won the tournament, he had this disastrous seven on this hole, a triple, and the ball just scooted over the green and into the water, and he had a trouble with the drop. But that's what I'm saying. There's trouble on both sides, and you can't just swing from the heels.
And let's take a look at the very next hole, the 12th. Again, not one of the most heralded holes on the back nine here, but it certainly takes its pound of flesh out of these guys.
Well, Eamon, in my view, this par 3 12th hole is the best par 3 on the back nine at TPC Scottsdale. Okay? What's going on with 12 is it's a medium length par 3 for these, you know, great players, 192 yards typically. But again, it's open in front. Weisskopf and Morris said, we've got municipal golfers playing here, give them some room to run it. But it's surrounded by a horseshoe of water, which means when the hole is placed all the way back, it plays as the hardest hole on the golf course, like it did in 2024. Because you don't dare attack that hole location. And, you know, consequently, you see a bunch of threes and three putts that cause that hole to be so difficult.
Second hardest hole on the course last year. Of course, the majority of the people hang out at 15, 16, 17, it's where the most noise is, but there's also a lot of risk and reward. Let's start with the par 5, 15th hole, because there's just a lot that can go right, but also a lot that can go wrong.
Well, maybe 20 years ago, the yardage had been 501, and then it just became ridiculously easy. So they scoped out another tee box way back, 553. But again, you're gonna see the problem, restraint and precision, not bomb and gouge. See how the water comes out on the left? So that's what's going on, is if you overcook a draw, you're gonna find the water. Jordan Spieth calls the 15th his favorite hole here, but it cost him dearly in 2021 because he knocked it into the water off the tee. So what happens then? Okay, island greens are a little more routine these days. They have shorter clubs coming in than they once did, but the green itself is a little tricky. Clear the water, don't hit it too far, but the back of the green has a little bit of a ridge, almost a shelf. And in the back left of that green, it actually comes left to right. So you think you've got a relatively easy birdie putt, but it's so slow, or even an eagle. By the same token, when the hole was cut back right, it's really quick and it can get away from you. Easiest hole location is front left. That's where they set it on Sunday. And that's where we can see at least the most eagles and the lowest scores.
Let's take a look at 16, where we are sitting right now. And this may be one of those holes, Joe, where there's a great debate. Is it the atmosphere of the Coliseum that these guys are in, or is it the actual strategy of the hole? And we don't often hear much about the strategy of this hole. We hear an awful lot about the atmosphere, but we take our live drone shot in here now coming from the tee box. What do we need to know about 16?
16, as 17 will be, is all about the hole location. Also, they have the option of moving the tee box up one day, which they do on typically on Saturday. So the hole only plays about 123. But if you set the hole back of the green, it's very much like Augusta's 16th. When they put the flag and the hole back right, like they often do on Saturday, it's kind of boring. It's sitting up on that shelf, and you don't see many birdies. You're just kind of two-putting from 20 and 30 feet. So here it is, the same thing at TPC Scottsdale. When the hole is cut middle or kind of front middle, it's gettable. You have a little shelf in the middle of the green and get some spin off that, and you got a lot of birdie putts and a chance at a hole in one. Put it back of the green or back right closer to that back bunker, and you're just looking at a bunch of threes, and it's not as exciting. So if you're coming on a Friday when the pin is back, don't expect a lot of excitement.
Oh, so many great moments, though. Tiger Woods, you think of James Hahn, you think of Harry Higgs, Joel Damon, and this hole has just gotten bigger and bigger and louder through the years. So you leave the par 3 16th, and you head over to what some call the best drivable short par 4 in all of golf. I'm, of course, talking about the 17th, where Brooks Koepka pitched in for eagle, where we've had the likes of Sahith Theegala and Ricky Fowler have their heart broken. What stands out to you, Joe, about this hole?
Well, Tom Weisskopf said it when he designed it. It's his favorite of all the 71 drivable par 4s that he ever did, because there's so many different ways to play it. That middle bunker you see there is not going to come into play for the pros. It once did, but no longer. So now what's going on is where the hole location is on the green. And the green is shaped like one of those foam fingers you see at sporting events. And most of the time on Sunday, it is back in the tip of that finger closest to the water. That's where things just get fantastic for this hole. Why I think it's even better than Riviera's 10th, because there's so many more possibilities here. The bailout is obviously short if you do it, but what can happen is if you hit it a little too far, as Sahith, well, there you go. Sahith Theegala did that a couple of years ago, and it hit a downslope and cascaded on into the water. You can also pull the ball left and find the water, as Ricky Fowler did, Spieth did that. So it is all about the hole location, and that's what makes it so much fun.
And it's only Monday, and it's already loud. Now listen, Joe, does the party atmosphere at all, which we love, and we love being here, does it obscure a little bit kind of the greatness of the bones of this golf course? Because when someone thinks of the WM, thinks of, oh, that's the big party, the greenest show on grass. But in terms of just the nuts and bolts of the golf course,
it's understandable how the party atmosphere definitely obscures some of the really good architecture.
Okay.
But what you want as a viewer, as a spectator at a PGA Tour event, is some excitement down the stretch. It's not the US Open. You want those possibilities of eagles and birdies and maybe some disasters, and you get them down the stretch here.
This is definitely not a USGA event.
The possibilities are endless, though, this week at the WM theme. So, Joe, always great to spend some time with you. You're like Crenshaw going through the hole by hole at Augusta National. Great job. We appreciate the time.
Happy to help. Hey, we got a warm week this week, guys.
Don't we know it. The party has already begun here on the Greenest Show on grass. Coming up, the nine best shots from the week that was. Great to be with you from the Valley.